everyone, and welcome to summer school. I'm Andrea Carnes. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a curator here at the Modern. And the education department, who are all the way together on a business trip, asked me to, if you can call it that, they're at the Venice Biennale, asked me to introduce Noah Symbolis to you today. No, I have known Noah as a friend, colleague, and supporter of the Modern for, I'd say, about 5 or more years now. And for that reason, I'm apologizing for reading to you the highlights of his career. But without going into details, I have 7 children at my house for the past 2 days, and I'm lucky to have my clothes on right. So instead of forgetting what I want to say, I'm going to read it. Noah Symbolis is a writer, curator, and artist. His current research focuses on the relationship between contemporary art and politics regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He won the 2007 Moss Chumley Award and has written for ArtLies, Art Papers, and Art Paper magazines, as well as web-based publications such as D Magazine, Front Row, Daily Serving, Glass Tire, and Might Be Good. He was the director of the Garner Tullis Print Publishing in New York and curated Yuri's Office, a project with Eve Sussman and the Rufus Corporation at the Fort Worth Contemporary Arts Center, with Christina Reese, by the way, who's here. Sorry, I've just lost my place. And also curated Out of Place at Laura Reynolds Gallery in Austin and Abstraction Construction at Soil Gallery in Seattle and Collecting Collectivity at the Conduit Gallery in Dallas and 3 propositions and a musical scenario in Fort Worth, which was co-curated by Subtext. He is the associate professor of art at SMU and was the 2010-2011 curatorial fellow at the Visual Arts Center at the University of Texas. Please welcome Noah Symbolis.
Thank you, Andrea, and thank you all for coming on this hot day. I guess it's nice to be in a cool place. So I'm also going to apologize for going in and out of reading a little bit. So beyond that stuff, one thing I wanted to tell you about myself in relationship to abstract expressionism was that I really started as an artist being sort of deeply, deeply affected by these kinds of works. I remember sort of having this experience when I was 17 years old in front of a Pollock painting, Autumn Rhythm at the Met, this sort of huge mural, and sort of standing in front of it for about a half hour until finally this sort of moment happened where it clicked and suddenly I felt sort of visually engulfed by the whole thing. And that was this really sort of transformative moment for me where I saw that something that seemed so flat and so other than sort of the world that we live in could somehow sort of affect us in a very visceral way. Over the years, I sort of tried to mimic this kind of painting and sort of mimic that experience that I could have for myself as a maker and for people who would actually experience it. But over time, I started to begin to mistrust it a little bit. In fact, I once had a studio visit with this painter named Andrew Forge, who was the dean of the Yale School of Art for a long time, and he said to me, looking at these massive paintings that I had in my studio, he says, "It seems like you're sort of tap dancing in front of these paintings instead of actually making them." And it really was true, because I think in some ways I was sort of engaged in a kind of nostalgia in real time. So that sort of started this, I mean, not that moment, it was a long process, but essentially I became more and more involved in theory and politics and things that seemed other than the kind of physicality of the making and the experiencing of these actual artworks. A couple of the shows that Andrea was talking about, for instance, this Out of Place show that has to do with Israel-Palestine, and also this show that I'm working on right now that's going to be at the Visual Arts Center in Austin called Queer States, has very much to do with the way that politics intersect with visual culture. So what I'm going to talk about today is a complex history. I'm trying to put together sort of multiple histories of abstract expressionism, one that might be more heroic, one that's its critique, and one that might be a kind of revival. It happens that the magazine Art Forum just published its summer issue that has to do with abstract expressionism. And I was very interested in this essay by a painter named Amy Silman, who talked very much about sort of the queering of abstract expressionism. It was called Abex and Disco Balls. We'll get to the relationship between Abex and disco at the end. So what I'm going to try to do is essentially guide you through the galleries, right? Because the galleries are set up, like most museums, as a picture of a history, right? And ultimately, they can be a picture of multiple histories. And it's those kinds of subtleties that I'm going to try to draw out. So first of all, there's this binary between the New York School or abstract expressionism as one movement that was the sort of transformative moment for the history of modern art and the history of American painting, but also this moment that sort of elicited a huge amount of anger and critiques. So what I'm going to do is to start with that binary, right? Like the binary of Abex is great and Abex is horrible. So we're going to go through that back and forth, and hopefully end up where we can sort of slip outside of those two possibilities, something that could be sort of a third possibility. Okay, so the abstract expressionism, which is also called sometimes the New York School because of a lot of the painters that were connected to it, included people like Jackson Pollock, these two pieces on the corner, Mark Rothko, Ed Reinhardt, over there Clifford Still, Philip Guston, and critics like Clement Greenberg and Harold Rosenberg. It was sort of in some ways, a loosely grouped crew of people who had some very different ideas of what art should be and even what politics should be. But what they were really trying to do was to sort of shift what was possible within art practice and painting practice in general, to shift literally the cultural landscape, the center of the cultural landscape from Europe, from Paris in particular, over to New York. So in this corner with these two Pollock paintings, this one on the right is the earliest of the group, and this shows sort of an earlier stage for Jackson Pollock. He was at the time very interested in Jungian psychoanalysis and the way that semiotics and signs could be used in painting discourse, and also very much influenced by Picasso. The painting, as you can see, involves a lot of faces or masks, actually, and that in many ways was referencing the way that Picasso famously used masks, and in particular tribal masks from Africa, to influence the way of thinking about how to abstract a portrait or face or anything that was otherwise would have been realistically painted. So that's the in some ways sort of the positive historicism of such a thing. But then on the other hand, there was this exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art called Primitivism in the mid-1980s that actually tried to evoke what I was just talking about, right? Sort of looking at the way that European and American artists in particular were being influenced by sort of primitive tribal cultures and taking from those cultures to get at an essence. I mean, because people like Picasso and Pollock were very interested in, like, African masks, for instance, because there was this idea that African tribes taking the whole continent and reducing it into sort of one notion, right? The African tribes were somehow more essential to human existence. So to take pieces of their culture was to reference that essence of human existence. That then was criticized very much as being ultimately slightly racist, slightly colonialist in its nature. And this began sort of a process where a lot of modern art became criticized in the culture wars in the 1980s and 90s. But that notion of essentialism, of getting down to the essence of humanity, was very much something that people like Pollock were trying to do. And they married that not just with, in the early stages, with references to those cultures and those visual histories, but then also towards abstraction, right? So Pollock, this is a later piece of his from 51, as compared with 38, where he was more influenced by European traditions like Cubism and Surrealism, where he moves towards a more pure expression, a more abstract expression of the essence of visual form, which also is a kind of structure for the nature of existence and humanity, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, let's move into this gallery. Okay, so in addition to Cubism and Surrealism, one of the things that a lot of these artists were very much interested in was the issue of a kind of heroic scale, of shifting canvases from easel paintings into something that could engulf you, that could produce exactly the experience that I was talking about in front of that large Pollock mural, right? And they were influenced in terms of scale by Mexican muralists such as Diego Rivera, Siqueiros, Orozco, and made these huge paintings that were going to resist being sort of commodities in a lot of ways, right? They were going to be large, heroic gestures that were going to resist being something that you would hang over your couch, that would be merely decorative, right? Unfortunately, museums grew bigger, corporate headquarters grew bigger, wealthy people's homes grew bigger, and they became just as easily commodified. But one of the things that was important for all of these artists was a few things that are somewhat contradictory, right? One has to do with flatness and materiality, like just the literalness, the facticity of paint and canvas and the picture plane, right? Things were going to literally come up to the surface. The second thing was that they were also going to be involved very much with gesture, right? Sort of the fact of something's making, right? So materiality and opticality were in a constant tension. And Clement Greenberg talked about this very much as sort of this crucial point where, like, if the history of art was thought of from Cézanne to Picasso to Jackson Pollock, it's almost as if the picture plane were like a drawbridge coming up from this sort of Renaissance picture plane that sort of went back in space. It slightly tipped up with Cézanne, then even further with Cubism, and then came almost to the surface with Abstract Expressionism. And it was that tension between the physicality and the self-referential aspect of the picture plane and just a hint of space that produced what Clement Greenberg really thought was like the crux of the tension of these works. So when Philip Guston, who started off making social realist works in a lot of ways, things that were very critical of the KKK, that were pro-union, that were very much involved in a kind of storytelling politics, erased all of that and became very much interested in those things that Greenberg was talking about. But in making these things, you can see that there's a space that starts to evolve. There are these sort of figurative elements, like these large black areas on top of those gray areas, and that gray sits on top of that pink area, and on that, on top of the canvas itself. So there's still a space there, even though it seems to be flat, right? There's a kind of opticality that's working together with the physicality, the literalness of the picture plane itself. So those things were very much in tension. The sort of heroic aspect of these things, the heroic aspect of making a gesture and making something really big and making something new and actually conquering the cultural dominance of Europe, became something that was crucial to this new American painting. And so much so that the U.S. government actually started sponsoring exhibitions that would move, that would travel from the U.S. to Europe, that were sponsored by an earlier version of the CIA, because there was this notion that American culture could be a kind of hidden weapon to literally display and perform our heroic nature, the fact that we are bigger and better than everyone, right? But the great irony of this, right, was that, like, the CIA was essentially sponsoring people like Barnett Newman, who ran for the mayor of New York under an anarchist platform, Philip Guston, who basically was very critical of the KKK pro-union and ultimately, like, was a socialist. You know, these are things that became very much in tension. So just like there's this tension between a kind of opticality and physicality, there also is this tension between these different kinds of politics. Ad Reinhardt, for instance, who was very much influential in moving towards a kind of There's not an example. There's an earlier example in the previous gallery, but he was known very much for these almost black paintings that he did that became very influential towards conceptual artists and minimal artists that we're going to see in a minute. But he also was making political cartoons at the same time. Those things were very much in tension. There's this notion of a kind of pure, essential way of reading, like American painting or abstract expressionism or the New York School, becomes complicated very much when you look at each of these people's practices. So let's go right here into the next gallery over there. So this is a painting by Hans Hofmann, who was sort of famous for a couple of things. One is that he's an example, for instance, of a transitional figure that was German originally and was an immigrant to the U.S. There's a hidden narrative inside of this kind of cultural shift from Europe to the U.S., which is not just a notion of invention and dominance. It's actually a product of a lot of Europeans that left Europe, which throughout the early 20th century, with World War I and World War II especially, produced a lot of refugees that ended up coming here. So Hofmann was one of them. He's famous for this notion of push-pull, getting back at this kind of opticality versus materiality, where you can start to see, if you sort of look at these paintings for a longer period of time, you start to see that certain sections of the painting will come forward and certain sections of the paintings will recede. And that has to do with a lot of complex things. Some have to do with value, essentially the sort of dark to light ratios between different areas of the painting. Some has to do with chroma, the color relationships, and some of those has to do even with edges, right? The difference between, say, like a hard edge and a soft edge, right? Like, so the speed and the direction of the painting and the way that it pushes out versus coming this way in an optical way, not necessarily a physical way, became crucial for him. He also was making a lot of these things from nature. And he taught in this famous school in Provincetown a lot of second-generation abstract expressionists to literally look at a model or look at a landscape and essentialize it towards an abstract form. So similar to how we were talking about Pollock earlier, where Pollock was sort of moving from these masks that were somewhat recognizable into these gestures that become purely abstract, Hofmann also was literally teaching people how to do that. And it was about the notion of form as a tool to sort of translate things from nature as we experience it into something that could be essentialized as a kind of purity. A couple of the students there included people like Lee Krasner and Joan Mitchell. Joan Mitchell went only once and said that he freaked her out, so she left. But it's notable, actually, that artists like Joan Mitchell, Elaine de Kooning, are essentially, you know, these are women who were associated with this movement who historically have been very much marginalized. And in some ways, it's emblematic of their relationship to Hofmann, right? Hofmann was the grand professore to the students who sort of would take in the sort of grand knowledge of this idea of purity and form. Also sort of the American who was more raw, who could take in the ideas of the sort of the European who was more knowledgeable and erudite and cosmopolitan. So that notion of the gendering of abstract expressionism is something that we're going to sort of end up with at the end, but it's a crucial part of the whole narrative, right? Because when we're talking about the heroic, grand, physical gesture that has power, political power, physical power, optical power, that kind of power was very much associated with masculinity, with literally men. So Elaine de Kooning was often known as her husband's wife, right? Lee Krasner, her husband's wife. Right, so they were secondary, not just as teacher-student, but also husband-wife. So just similarly to the 1980s exhibition Primitivism, which was critiquing this brand of modernism in terms of race, ethnicity, colonialism, a lot of people became, in the 1980s especially, became very critical of abstract expressionism because of its gendering, because of the fact that it was dominated not necessarily literally, but in some, certainly historically, in the way it was historicized, the way that many museums actually bought and exhibited the works, that there was a dominance of men within this movement. So we're going to move on. Yes?
Was there one particular leader that laid down the criteria for abstract? Was that something that the critics tapped onto it? Was it the illusion, no illusionism, blackness, etc.?
Great question. There, within the artists, I think that there's a number of different camps. There were some very erudite people, like Robert Motherwell, Ed Reinhardt, Mark Rothko wrote a lot, and his friend Adolf Gottlieb, who also wrote quite a bit. And these people sort of were writing and very active as public intellectuals for arguing for this. But it was the critics that really became the main proponents of this particular narrative of abstraction, Clement Greenberg in particular. Okay, let's head over this way. Okay, so if there was this idea of the space of an artwork starting from Renaissance perspective, right, something that receded back in space and then slowly became flattened more and more, that artists became self-conscious or self-referential towards the picture plane and the physicality and materiality of painting, it's really started to get to that point, as I spoke of before, where it was almost at the apex, almost at a pure verticality. In the mid-1950s and 1960s, there was a group of artists that later became sort of termed more in relationship to a movement called minimalism that took that trajectory and threw it outside of the canvas and onto the floor. Right, so literally it took this sort of 180 trajectory. Frank Stella wrote this book called Working Space that literally talks about that process, where the space comes out from the canvas and into the space itself. Michael Fried, actually, who was friends and actually the college roommate of Frank Stella, later talked about that notion in terms of the kind of performance of the physicality of something in relationship to us as viewers. He meant it as a critique. He meant it as a bad thing. But to some degree, it was actually quite true. So this sculpture becomes very much about flatness and materiality, taking quite literally Clement Greenberg's notions about what abstract expressionism was all about and taking them to their logical extent. And so in some ways, what it also starts to do is it performs a notion of abstraction. It performs a kind of... I apologize for the word, a teleological trajectory. It's basically something that is about a one-directional notion of history and a unidirectional idea of space and materiality, where something literally does like a belly flop onto the floor. And we hear the echo of that slap. We respond to the echo of that slap. We try to figure out like where we stand in relationship to this. So in some ways, what this starts to do is this takes the notion of performance and materiality and the maker of that materiality and the way that we perform a kind of politics in relationship to that materiality, and it puts the onus on us as viewers, as people who experience this thing, to figure out what we do with this. So do we possibly walk on the thing and participate in its materiality? Do we let it stay further away so that we engage it more as a kind of opticality? Or do we allow it to exist somewhere in between the two? Okay, let's head over to the minimalism and then we'll get up to the disco balls. Thank you. Okay, so this is when history gets a little bit more complicated. So in one sense, like, you know, Karl-Andre was very much, this is another piece of his, and Karl-Andre was very much sort of engaged with a group of people in a dialogue about this notion of sort of materiality and the fact of an artwork, the kind of isolated fact of an artwork being something in and of itself. Donald Judd spoke very much about, this stack piece by the artist Donald Judd, spoke very much about sort of the wanting to move away from painting in order to move to sort of empty out the art object from any kind of content that could be sort of poured inside of it, so that it could be taken on its own terms. Again, like Karl-Andre, what we were talking about with Karl-Andre, it's very much about sort of looking at the materiality as just the logical extent of how everything that was talked about in relationship to abstract expressionism. In visual terms, I think that Bryce Marden's early painting over here, or the Robert Mangold over there, give us a kind of in-between point, right? So if we were looking at Philip Guston's painting, or the Motherwell, or even the Pollock, they're abstract, but you can still discern a kind of figure-ground relationship. Like with those Guston's, you can see those masses of dark in relationship to the field below. There's still a space that you can discern. There's still a push-pull in Hans Hofmann's terms. But it's much harder, like possibly if you look at the Bryce Marden, you can begin to read this like a Rothko, where you might see those two planes sort of pushing and pulling back and forth to one another, but it resists that. And then the Mangold resists that even more, because the only thing that you have as a figure-ground relationship is the sort of physical, optical line in the center in relationship to the larger plane. But then when you look at objects in and of themselves, like the Andre, the Jackie Windsor, the Richard Serra over there, or the Judd, that sense of opticality, of figure-ground relationships, becomes emptied. You just have to take these things on their own and then have a relationship to them in an external way. But one of the questions with that, that emptying out and that emphasis on materiality is that the question is there a particular kind of materiality that is privileged? Right, like, is that, why is it that everything is so colorless? Right, why is it that these things seem emptied of drips of, like, of the messiness of things? Right, like, why do they? And often that's why minimalism is described in sort of austere, hyper intellectual terms. And part of that is because, and the relationship between minimalism and conceptualism. This Lawrence Wiener text piece on the side over there, they were very much related. Like Saul LeWitt becomes in many ways the tie that binds between sort of a kind of minimalism and conceptualism. And one of the reasons for that is that as much as these works are about materiality and the fact of their existence, these are ideas. They're not necessarily experiences. They're not necessarily experiences that even the makers were very much involved with, right? Donald Judd is famous for working with outside people who made the work for him. Right? Like, what does it mean to literally take one's hand out of the materiality of making? It means that you're talking about materiality as an idea that is external to yourself. So the notion of abstract expressionism is using abstraction and using the physicality of materials to express something about oneself, and oneself as a kind of microcosm of all of existence becomes much more complicated when the expression is done through a surrogate. Like, what do you do when there's a surrogate that is about that expression? And I think minimalists and conceptualists were very much involved in the parallel between that surrogate, right? Like, someone who makes the work for you, you as an artist, you, this person, the maker, this thing, the object, as potentially sort of a mirror of the way that the object acts as a surrogate or acted as a surrogate of expression for the self of the artist, right? Like, you've got yourself, the object, and someone who experiences it. It's already distanced. Like, abstract expressionists didn't just stand in the middle of the room and scream. I mean, they did that often, but they didn't call it art. You know, I mean, when Jackson Pollock went to his dealer's house, went up to her bedroom and peed in her fireplace, he was, you know, that was the story very much told about being symbolic of, like, his expression, the expression of his manhood, of his power, of his base qualities, and those base qualities being tied to the tribalism that he ultimately aspired to. I mean, those things were about their lives. They didn't integrate that necessarily self-consciously into what the artworks were. Whereas this moment of minimalism conceptualism starts a moment where that kind of performance becomes much closer to what the artwork really is. Okay, so I think we're ready for disco ball. So we're gonna go back to the room we started in, but just keep an eye out for what we passed through. I took us through a sort of circuitous trajectory, which is a trajectory of one history, but that's not the history that's necessarily told here. So I had to sort of go to great pains to tell that history because it's been subverted a little bit in the way that these galleries have been set up. Okay, so we're back to the beginning in some ways. So in this essay that Amy Silliman wrote in Art Forum, one of the things that she talks about is the gendering of abstract expressionism, something that we sort of touched on a little bit with Pollock peeing in the fireplace, or sort of its analog, Andy Warhol's piss paintings, essentially. And the way that, like, you know, Pollock's work emulated that kind of physicality, but also a kind of masculine drive, the absence of a lot of women from this discourse. Amy Silliman was talking a lot of ways about the sort of the place of abstract expressionism in history today. You know, in a lot of ways, they've been maligned. We talked about many of the ways that abstract expressionists have been maligned for being masculinist, racist, homophobic, colonialist, etc. But what she talks about is sort of is the possibility of not throwing out the baby with the bathwater, right? Like, how is it possible to still take, in a way, the kind of pathetic and possibly even vulgar notion of expression, right? Like, in some ways, she was talking about abstract expressionism, like the expression of an abstract artist, almost like the idea of, like, a grown-up crying. Right, or even possibly like a grown man crying. There's something sort of vulgar about it, something that is not tasteful, but potentially could be quite tender. And she connects two ways of thinking that are you would normally think are being totally disconnected. Clement Greenberg's reading of the purity of abstraction and the kind of masculinist notion of abstraction with Susan Sontag's essay, Notes on Camp. And she talks about camp as a kind of elevation of the vulgar, an elevation of expression, where people can have so much feeling that it starts to embarrass us. And that notion of elevating camp and elevating feeling is something that is often thought of as being queer, something that is other than our sort of traditional ways of thinking about gender and how what is proper within society, what is normal within society, normal behavior. So essentially what she was arguing for was a way of reading abstract expressionism or new forms of abstract art making to function almost like drag queens, like basically drag queens who embrace camp, who embrace sort of an over effluviant notion of expression, of emotion, and of feeling. And that could be something that could be tender. So for instance, like here we've got David Hockney, who challenge sort of two notions, one being, well, actually three at least. sort of basically an artist who moved back and forth between Europe and America, London and LA in particular, who is also a gay man, who sort of embraced images that in some ways alluded to his sexuality and the sexuality of people around him, but also moving away from abstraction into figuration. And maybe a fourth thing of sort of embracing popular culture as something that could have a relationship to sort of fine art, right? And Francis Bacon, who also sort of subverts the Greenbergian notion of like the teleology of history, right? How we move from figuration towards the purity of abstraction. So in the mid 1950s, 60s until his death, that he was still making figurative works that were very much about materiality and very much about feeling and very much about the fact that he was a gay man. Jackson Pollock, towards the end of his life, started moving away from abstraction. He used the same technique of sort of making these drip paintings, but started making figurative things again. It's basically sort of coming back full circle from the earlier work where we saw the mask and these sort of hidden faces within things, where you can start to see sort of a head at the bottom, a knee that comes off over there on the right, but still taking account of the drippiness and the tenderness of material, right? So that there could be something that is about a purity of feeling that doesn't have to be beholden to sort of one idea of history, one idea of purity that he is necessarily staying inside of. And even though, like I'm pointing to these guys as if like these are literally the gay dudes and that's the queerness, but Jackson Pollock was far from that. In fact, like when he died, he had his mistress in the car, and there's a long story that is another sort of normative story of straight masculine behavior. But there's something in his artwork that displayed a notion of camp. There's something in his artwork that was much what Amy Silman describes in relationship to disco, right? Like disco was something that that was very much tied to the gay community, very much tied to sort of a celebration of feeling. Like it was loud, it was funny, it was about again this sort of like hyper-inflated camp. And as a result, it had a very deep relationship to drag queens and to gay culture. But there was this, has anyone ever heard the phrase, disco sucks? and these little buttons that people used to wear. I mean, the notion of disco being bad, just like Abex has had this reputation of being bad, was because it was basically moving against the norm. Like, basically, abstract expressionism only became bad once there was this sort of austere, minimal, masculinist behavior that became the norm. Abstract expressionism became bad because there was too much feeling. It was a little vulgar, a little embarrassing for these big dudes to be sort of spraying stuff all over the place, right? There was too much feeling. One needed to become more austere and strangely Victorian, like in the late 20th century. Right? And similarly with disco. Disco was bad because it didn't have the kind of like rhythmic rock and roll that we understand to be a kind of masculinist gesture. It was something that was much larger. And disco sucks essentially became like a creed for people who were essentially embarrassed for this kind of this queer performance of culture. And so, like, these two things, disco and abex, you would never think as being sort of more different. But what I found really interesting, and I thought was really great about this moment, like, giving a gallery talk about abstract expressionism, this has happened, like, since the 60s, people explaining how the history went. I found it really interesting that at this moment, this isn't just a kind of ahistorical history out of time. This is coming, like these galleries exist at a moment where a lot of young artists are sort of repurposing abstraction and repurposing feeling in a way that isn't bound with the same kinds of embarrassed looks away that that really people have been following for the past 20, 30 years. Abstraction and a kind of material, drippy, tender abstraction of feeling is something that a lot of artists are starting to embrace more and more. Anyway, so that's my talk. Does anyone have questions? Yep. Well, within sort of this, within Amy's paradigm, and I'm using this also sort of in a broader way, the answer would be no. But there have been a lot of histories, and Rothko, you know, was an author of the history where the answer would have been yes. That is absolutely wrong. I mean, I had a high school art teacher who went to Hoffman School in Provincetown, and when we would do these critiques in front of these abstract things that we would make, and someone would raise their hand and say, like, oh, I see a face, you would start screaming for 10 or 15 minutes about how horrible you were for projecting your own sense on the purity of the thing itself. So, you know, and Rothko in many ways was fighting so hard to make these things autonomous. I mean, part of the anger for that was a real genuine desire to make painting transcendent of the horrible world that people existed in the 20th century, right? I mean, with the number of wars and all of these terrible things. And he was trying to make something that could exist separate from that, that could be a respite from that. But part of the problem is that, like, even as I mentioned with sort of the CIA project of bringing these paintings, like, these things can't exist separate from who we are and the stories that we tell about them. Anyone else? Oh, yeah.
Just one more beautiful question.
Sure.
So if anything in the minimalist room is beautiful to you, is that also offensive to minimalists?
I think that's a little bit different for each artist. And again, you get into the problem of these terms like abstract expression, minimalism, the New York School. Like, these are constructions that happened often after the fact. So, you know, for instance, Agnes Martin, who's hanging in that room, would wholeheartedly basically say that the key to those works is a kind of beauty, and a beauty of the work which is tying together sort of abstract form and her experience of nature.
She explicitly said that she was an abstract expression.
Yeah.
And not.
Right.
She was really upset about that.
Yeah.
Because she was lumped in her own show. And
totally.
To the end of her days, which were in the 90s,
yeah.
She was saying, I'm an abstract expression of my things
about. Yeah, and this is the thing that's really very confusing about these histories, because Agnes Martin or Ellsworth Kelly over there are engaged in a very different kind of abstraction, and they've been historicized in a very different way than, say, like Rothko or Newman, who you might say that Newman and Reinhardt have more relationship to Ellsworth Kelly and Agnes Martin than, say, like Clifford Still or Jackson Pollock. But it's the way that they've been historicized after the fact, I think. Carolyn.
Well, I was just going to ask you to talk a little bit more. You talked about the political aspects in parts of the history, and then in this kind of last area, I realized the associating the disco with camp, there's kind of a political dimension to that.
For sure, yeah.
I was wondering if you could make a little more explicit if there were any other political aspects. Well, I don't know, Mueller. I mean, I guess it was really interesting, for example, to hear about the tension between CIA promoting and something that's going to promote the American way of life or whatever.
Right.
Dominance. And while the artists themselves, it sounds like we're kind of the opposite in their thinking. I just wonder if there were, say, minimalism, were there, did the artists see their work as having political implications or,
I see what you're saying. I mean, and I think, again, these histories start to break down, you know, in any kind of cohesive way. But when I'm talking about sort of a queering of this history, or even the artist sort of self-identifying as queer, I mean that as a political thing. In the same way that, you know, sort of Gustin making work in relationship to the KKK, or in relationship to labor and unions, or Newman, you know, as an anarchist. Like, I see queer politics, the gender politics that were sort of hidden within people like Krasner and Elaine de Kooning and all that. Like, those are all political things. So some of them are politics of the body, and some of them seem to be politics of ideology, but the politics of the body are just as much about ideology as the CIA, you know. Yep.
Yeah, I'm sure you were correct. The emotional
intensity of the irascibles.
Yes.
Over into the forcefulness of the painting that you see with the abstract expression.
Yes.
That emotion of the characters, middle characters, was part of.
For sure, yeah. I mean, I think that's. It does become very complicated, and I think when you talk about the irascibles, I just want to just refer to what you just talk a little bit about the term that you brought up. Like, there's a famous photograph of a lot of these artists that is like refers to them as the irascibles, and it was taken in the club, which was a place where a lot of them met. In that photograph, it's all men except for Hedda Stern, who's the one woman. And they met to talk about these ideas. So as much as this work, you know, these artists and the work that they were carrying out was about physicality and feeling and the studio practice, they were also very much engaged in a lot of philosophical discourse. And so like the notion of the club or the Cedar Tavern where they gathered to talk, like these were things that were pulling together sort of like logos and eros, right? Things that were about like talking, thinking, writing, as opposed to feeling. Yeah.
Have you ever thought how much art in America would change in the 20th century if Warhol thought he fit into being an irascible?
I think he did think of himself as an irascible, but as a different kind. And I don't think that club would let him in. Okay, well, thank you.